This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
Hello and welcome to Hurt Less, Live More, the show where we explore all the hurts that we might have experienced in life and look at ways that we've either got through it or ways that we could have got through them all. And I'm JJ, the Practical Alchemist. I'm here as ever with Dr. Mark Goulston, psychiatrist and coach. And we have a special guest today, don't we, Mark?
We absolutely do. So let me mention, Marcy Glidden Savage was on my podcast, my wake-up call, and she wrote a book called And Nobody Saw It Coming, and she's had two husbands who have died by suicide. And if I'm listening into this, if I met Marcy, I wouldn't know what to say. I mean, I don't know how that would come out in conversation. And before we started, Marcy said, yeah, I run into that a lot. I mean, it's a show and game stopper when you meet people. And I may have shared this with you when you were on my wake-up call, because I had a patient years ago whose only child was murdered. And when people say, do you have children? You know, she goes into it and they're so awkward. And so my advice to her was to, I guess in pre-COVID days, you could touch someone on the shoulder to reassure them. And my advice to her was to say to these people, that's okay, because if I was you, I wouldn't know what to say either.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't know what to say either, Marcy.
Yes.
And you were saying that, you know, that's the response you get all the time from people.
All the time. Yes.
Yeah. Quite extraordinary. So, I mean, I'm very curious to find out how you get over such a thing, because two husbands who committed suicide within five years between the two. So that's a huge amount of grief to process in such a short space of time. How are you still sitting there talking to us? How are you still standing?
And also, how'd you make the decision to come out and talk about it? Because a lot of people would tuck it away and hope it doesn't even come out in conversation. So address both those things.
Well, in short, I gave myself permission to heal. I certainly had counseling for 4 or 5 years. But what I realized is that a counselor, psychologist, psychiatrist, friends, family couldn't give me permission to heal.
Mm.
So they were saying those things. I actually had to do it myself. I think a lot of people in grief get stuck in that place where they just don't allow themselves to heal. They don't know how to heal. They don't feel right about healing when someone they've loved has passed. But I think I just knew, if I don't give myself permission to heal, I might not ever heal. And so I did, and that allowed me to do a lot of reading and, you know, find ways to heal. And one of the most important ways for me was I read Megan Devine's book, and she gave a a writing prompt to her students that I thought was just excellent. And it was an exercise in personification. And, you know, she said, look, if you have a major character in your book, you know, you need to know what they talk, how they talk, how they sit, how they comb their hair, all those things. So, you know, the prompt was, how did grief introduce himself or herself to you? And I thought, wow, wow, great. That's amazing, because now grief can sit over there in that chair and I don't have to carry grief around. Grief is always going to be with me, but I can talk to grief instead of just in my own head. And so by doing that exercise and writing down, you know, how, what I felt about grief the moment they showed up, I mean, the rage and the anger and go away, I don't want you here, this can't be real, to eventually my understanding that grief was the only entity that knew exactly how I felt at every moment of my life. You know, I hid how I felt from my children, sometimes from my friends, people that I would meet. But grief absolutely understood everything I was thinking and feeling. And so grief became a teacher and almost a companion. And particularly so after my second husband passed. When Paul died in 2014, we had been engaged in the community, had raised our kids and lots of friends, lots of activities. And so he was very beloved. You know, again, we had a 40-year romance from the age of 17 and he was 19. And so I was really kind of protected by people's real thoughts about his death. But when I remarried and it happened again, the anger was, I don't know that I've ever been in an environment that was so angry. And intellectually, I understood their anger. I would have been angry had it been my friend and her. And yet I got lost in the anger. My grief got lost, my loss of love, my, you know, and I felt like no one wanted to be quiet about how angry they were at him. And so grief really became my friend at that point. And I learned that I needed to show up for myself. This was my story, but it wasn't Marcy. It's Marcy's story, but it's not my character. It's not my intelligence. It's not the way I conduct my life. It doesn't have anything to do with my ability to love, to be kind, to be compassionate. It's my story. And I'm not afraid of my story anymore. I know I get those reactions. But what I ultimately would like people to see is that despite losing love and my life imploding, I mean, completely changing, I was able to show up for myself and honor Marcy and her life. I mean, I have a quote right here, and if I might just read it, it's from Walter Anderson, and I'm sure you know it, but he wrote, "Although I may not be able to prevent the worst from happening, I am responsible for my attitude toward the inevitable misfortune that darkens life. Bad things do happen. How I respond to them defines my character and the quality of my life. I can choose to sit in perpetual sadness, immobilized by the gravity of my loss, or I can choose to rise from the pain and treasure the most precious gift I have, life itself. And I read this in a magazine in my psychologist's office one day, just picked it up waiting and read it. And it was a bit of a divine moment, I think. I mean, it was a light bulb. I thought, well, yeah, I do need to embrace the change and embrace my life. My life is worth living. I'm worthy of it. So in a nutshell, that's kind of what I've done over the past 9 years.
Wow. That's some journey, really.
There have been a few times in my life when I have felt suicidal. A big part of it was a feeling of failure, feeling of humiliation, feeling of ashamed, feeling of embarrassed. And I'm not a religious person, but I guess I thank God that I pushed through. A story that JJ knows, and maybe I shared it with you when you were on my podcast. One of my low points was dropping out of medical school, and I think the head of the school was knowing that they wanted to kick me out, and he was afraid that I'd go off the deep end. And so he sent me over to the dean of students who cared about students, and he hit me with the trifecta of hope when he told me that I was going to be kicked out. He said, and I came from a background where you're only worth what you can do and accomplish, and if you can't do anything or accomplish anything, you're not worth anything. A not unusual male thing. I think women often die or from the pain of loss, mm-hmm. whereas for us men, it gets complicated with ego and that sort of thing. And what the dean of students said is, he said, you're messed up, but you didn't mess up. I mean, you passed everything. And then he said, but even if you don't get unmessed up, even if you don't do anything with the rest of your life, even if you don't become a doctor, I'd be proud to know you. And that was at a low point. And I said, what? He said, I'd be proud to know you because you have something in you that the world needs, and you won't know it till you're 35, but you're going to make it till you're 35. And I was at the time probably 26, 27. And so he had sort of an unconditional love for me. I'd be proud to know you. What? You won't know how much the world needs this thing that I see in you till you're 35. So he saw a future for me. And then I think the thing that he really did that probably was the linchpin to saving me, he said, but you've got to make it to your 35. You deserve to be on this planet, and you're going to let me help you. Because if he had said to me, call me if I can help you, I may have gone back to my, apartment. I probably wouldn't have reached out. And, there's a good chance I wouldn't be here. But when he said, you're going to let me help you, it's like he grabbed me by the nape of the neck. Mm. And said, you're not going anywhere. And I internalized that. Those three things, unconditional love, so I couldn't screw it up, a future, and, you look a little helpless right now, so I'm going to help you. And he arranged an appeal. And he stood up against the medical school and said, we're giving this one a second chance. And I internalized that. Mm-hmm. It's almost like I died and was reborn. And again, I'm not a religious person, but those three things is kind of what I did and paid it forward after I finished medical school, became a psychiatrist, and one of my focuses was suicide prevention. And but I can see if there was conditional love, like, what is wrong with you? Blah, 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 blah. It would have just hammered me inside. And if no one could see a future for me, if someone had rubbed my face in it, or I was rubbing my own face in it, saying, you know, you're not worth very much. You know, you're not going to do much for the world. But he countered all of those.
Oh, I believe that most, if not all men, you know, gather their self-esteem and their self-worth by what they're able to provide for their families or to society. And unlike women, you know, we have other, you know, we have girlfriends and we have children. We find it other ways. But men don't talk to each other like this wonderful man spoke to you. That is, I'm not going to say it's a one-off, but it is not usual. Therefore, men don't reach out when they're hurting. It's a sign of weakness and all of that. And I will say, when you've lost someone by this death, it's the only death, I believe, where your loved one's character, life, achievements are re-evaluated and rethought. Even though you've known the person for 58 years, now you question, did you really know them? And, you know, that's, for me, that's wrong. That's just unnecessary pain.
And so many assumptions are made as well when this happens. And we'll maybe talk about that a little later. But we will go to a break right now. We'll be back with much more after these messages from our station sponsors.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Hurt Less, Live More here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio station. And I'm back again with Dr. Mark Goulston and Marcy Glidden-Savage. And Marcy, your story is so powerful. And I know that beyond just getting over it, what you're doing now is campaigning, is the best word for it, I guess, to remove the stigma that surrounds suicides and mental illness or just depression, that kind of thing, because there is still that real stigma around anybody who confesses to being depressed, being, you know, not being able to cope, having issues with their mental health, still there.
I believe it's the bottom line. And I believe that until we as a society, as a world, realize that those stigmas are so archaic, centuries and centuries ago.
Yeah.
And when the media will stop only portraying people that have struggles with mental health as, you know, mass shooters and chaos all over the world, that we can do help. We can do telethons. We can run races. We can garner funds. We can do all those things for suicide awareness and prevention. But until we change the way, as people, we talk to each other, and I don't believe we're ever going to make big inroads. The stigma, once you lose someone, is no longer on them. They're not here to hear it anymore. The family is, the friends are, the colleagues are. And I just don't know anywhere in any death that it is acceptable, appropriate to question your loved one's loss and how. I just can't imagine walking up to a friend of mine whose husband has cancer and saying to her, well, didn't you see that Didn't you see anything
Yeah.
before?
Yeah.
Why did you get him to a doctor sooner? Are you having financial problems? You couldn't get help from a doctor? Just the unnecessary questions and the stigma of, again, both my husbands were 58 years old. They were very successful businessmen. They had a lot of anxiety because they felt stressed to perform for their families and provide, and they were well loved. They were told they were loved. They were shown they were loved. They were a hero to their children. And yet they also were prescribed medications for depression, for not being able to sleep, for anxiety. And I would say that both were also believed they had their own medical degree and could self-medicate themselves sometimes, and which can be easy to hide from a lot of people, even from the woman that you've slept with for, you know, over 34 years. And I think that's not uncommon. My second husband, Michael, lost his vice president job about 6 months before. Had been a vice president of global proportions in the aerospace industry for 30 some odd years. Difficult to find a job of that nature again at that age. My first husband, Paul, had suffered prostate cancer 4 years before, and all that entails. It's a very intimate cancer in a marriage. And even though, you know, your partner, your wife may do everything in their power to work through those things, you know, it's a part of a male that you just can't, you know, talk, they just can't express how they feel about that. But it is certainly akin, I believe, to women who have breast cancer and have, you know, maybe their breasts removed. And so a lot of things, men in their late 50s, and that's why there's such a big proportion outside of our youth that unfortunately die by suicide. And, you know, to me, that's a manner of death. It's like a car accident or pneumonia when you have COVID or cancer. It's a manner of death. It's not what killed them, I don't believe. And, you know, when we as a society can start talking about that as a real illness and not some bad, like crazy, you know, that it just is what it is. It's like cancer. It's like Alzheimer's. It's got its own symptoms and its own trajectory. And it can be undiagnosed, like skin cancer. I mean, it can, you know, it's just an illness. And we need to treat it as that. And when we can, then I believe that we can give certainly more men permission to, like, talk about it. Tell your buddy, tell your best friend, you know, and not question, well, are you having financial problems or marriage problems? You got to be having marriage problems, or is the job just too much for you? I mean, we don't question those things when somebody says, hey man, I got cancer.
Yeah, I completely resonate with what you're saying there as well. And even though I am not a man, I have suffered from depression and didn't talk about it. You don't talk about it. You hide it. What was I going to say? Did anybody know how to deal with it? Did anybody know how to respond? I didn't think so. I used to say that I, you know, went down the steps to hell at one point, and might not have come back, but somehow managed to drag myself back.
I want to throw something out into the mix because I'd never thought about this before. And so it's half baked, and maybe we'll fully bake it. As we're talking about stigma, I'm thinking of four words: helpless, powerless, useless, worthless. Helpless, powerless, useless, worthless. And I'm wondering how much the stigma is that people, especially men, feel such an aversion to feeling helpless, powerless, useless, worthless, that they will do anything to avoid feeling it. You know, they'll drug themselves, they'll drink, they'll eat, and whatever. And I'm seeing how, especially veterans, you know, veterans have trouble reaching out. And a lot of times what they're feeling is helpless, powerless, useless, worthless. And I could see how if they're reaching out to a friend or a mental health professional, I think what they're actually wanting is for someone to, there's a term, not just hold space, but they want to feel felt by someone else. I had a supervisor, very smart, and he said, before you see a patient, you should do a mental health check about how you're feeling. Because if you're feeling okay, when you're with that patient and you start to feel helpless, powerless, whatever, they're wanting you to feel it so they don't have to feel it alone. Mm. And because there's something about feeling alone with those things, or feeling someone being, you know, a professional but at a distance, and it makes you feel like an idiot for having opened it up. And one of the things he taught me, which was so elegant and eloquent, he'd say, when someone is causing you to feel that way, what you might say to them is, you're really doing a good job. And they're going to go, what? What do you mean I'm doing a good job? And you say, you're really doing a good job of helping me to feel what it feels like to feel helpless, powerless, useless, and worthless. And it's so painful. And I get to leave this office not feeling it, and you don't.
Right.
And I'm so sorry that it hurts so much. I do think there's a way through it. I do think there's even a way to get past it. But right now, I'm so sorry that you feel that way, because I'm just getting a taste of it, and it feels awful. Mm. And it was, so, do you follow me, Marcy? It was so elegant.
Yes.
Now, some people who have such an aversion will say, well, that's unprofessional. Well, aren't you laying a guilt trip? No, it's being empathic at the most level, because you're saying, I just felt what you felt, and it feels awful, and I'm so sorry you feel this way, which I think gives you an entree into them, because, you know, you're not judging them, you're being compassionate, and then you can say just calmly, I know you don't see a way through this or past this, and in this moment, feeling what you feel, I don't see a way through it, but I'm here to tell you that there is a way through it. There is a way to get through it, because I've seen that happen hundreds of times. Right now, I'm so immersed in what you're feeling and how much it hurts. I can also feel like there's no way through it, but I'm here to tell you that there is.
I wish I'd give anything, really, to have had any inkling at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
After, you know, loving someone the majority of my life, I would have given anything to be there on his worst day ever. Let me, you know, I would have given anything to have been there, to have said anything, to have held a hand. I mean, oftentimes there's, it's kind of like, you hear that people that are terminally ill with cancer, they'll rally right before. And I believe that to be true with Paul. We had the most amazing weekend prior to that Wednesday. I mean, it was like we were kids again. I mean, we had a wonderful time. In fact, we were at a concert and the young couple next to us, halfway through leaned over and said, how do you guys do it? And we said, what do you mean? They said, well, we don't know you, but clearly you guys are in love. And I just said, well, we never fell out of love on the same day, I guess. I mean, we had a wonderful time. But the thing that worries me going forward is there's already such a lack of personal connection with the internet, with social media, and all of that. I mean, we're backing ourselves behind the eight ball even further. We need to be able to connect with each other. We need to be able to just lean in, and not as eloquently, certainly, Mark, as your example, but I had a friend that lost a 3-year-old, and I walked out of my house with my healthy 3 children. I grabbed a box of Kleenex. I walked down the street to her house, walked in the door, sat down and with my Kleenex and just said, I don't know how you breathe. I don't. That's all I could say because I didn't know what else to say. But at least she understood I'm hurting and acknowledging your hurt and your pain.
Yeah. And she would have understood that just being there. Yeah.
Leaning in. I call in my book, I have a chapter on lean in heroes, how to lean in and what that looks like. And little things that, to lean in and not say, call me if you need me. I actually said to a neighbor, I'm not going to call you. I'm just telling you that doesn't happen. You're just going to have to show up but we have done a remarkable job as a world, as a society of changing our wrongs and righting our wrongs and our attitudes towards people, whether it is the color of their skin, whether it is their sexuality. We haven't conquered it. We haven't done 100% great, but we've made remarkable inroads into that.
Yeah.
So we can do it. We can. And until that stigma goes away. I mean, my daughter didn't get help for 5 years because she did not want to walk into a psychologist's office and have to explain who her daddy really was. I mean, she wanted them to know the daddy that was always there. I mean, and not just the last day of his life. And then let's talk about healing you. No, she wants, the whole story, know how wonderful he was. And then try to heal me. I don't want other people to go through that. And I certainly, I see, the first thing families want to do when a wonderful soccer player, dies in California and a young one or a Miss USA or jumps off a building in New York. The first thing the family is, they were wonderful. They were smart. They were, you're desperate for people to remember who they actually were and not this last few minutes of a life doesn't erase all that. But to everyone around us, it feels as though their lives were just erased and this was it. This was their story now. So that's why I will speak and I will speak until my last breath about let's change this. Let's do better. We can.
Yeah. We can. And you speak beautifully about it, Marcy. Let's carry on talking about this. First of all, though, let's just take a short break to hear these messages from our station sponsors. We'll be back right after this with me, Mark, and Marcy.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
The station that makes you feel good.
And you are listening to Hurt Less, Live More here on UK Health Radio with me, JJ, the Practical Alchemist, Dr. Mark Goulston, and our guest today, Marcy Glidden-Savage, author of And No One Saw It Coming. And, you know, we've been talking about stigma. And Mark, I mean, do you have any theories as to why the stigma isn't really going away as quickly as we might have hoped?
Yeah. Well, we mentioned something earlier that that if I share with someone that I'm feeling helpless, powerless, useless, and worthless, It actually feels contagious because they don't know what to say, you know? And what happens is, even if they say something, I can feel, well, there, I've gone and burdened them. And the burden, I don't think, is that I share it with them. It's that they don't know what to say. And out of that anxiety, they throw solutions. Well, you should do such and such, which if you're the person sharing those things, you're smiling politely and you're thinking, why did I even open up about it? And I think what it is if I'm there feeling suicidal, I feel helpless, powerless to make the pain go away. And if I share with someone, that I'm feeling that and helpless and powerless, I really think it is to cause them to feel it with me. I once heard a great quote, pain is pain. Suffering is feeling utterly alone in pain. Mm-hmm. And when you can lessen the aloneness in people, suffering they can't live with becomes pain they can.
That's an excellent quote.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
I'll share. This is a slight tangent, but we'll get back to it. You know, I do executive coaching. You know, so out in the business world, mm-hmm. there's been a stigma against me as a psychiatrist in the business world. And the reason being is you can be a psychologist, but that's because there's hundreds of psychologists. You can be organizational psychologist. You can be a performance psychologist. You can be whatever. And what people would tell me is they'd say, I can't refer anyone to you because when they look you up and they see you're a psychiatrist, they're going to say to me, what do you think? I'm crazy. Do you think I need medication? And it's an awkward conversation. And something I feel actually good about is I've actually joined a company called On Global Leadership, and I'm heading up their Deeper Coaching Institute. And the idea is that some people who have coaching not only find out strategies, but they find out things about themselves that they never knew that really open doors, and they might want to go deeper. But the majority of coaches who come from the business world can, you know, can sort of look into it and you can talk about your limiting beliefs and how it's not working for you, but you don't really go deeper.
Right.
So I'm excited. I've changed my whole LinkedIn profile about this because it makes sense that, well, a psychiatrist, if there's someone in the mental health profession who's highly trained, they could probably go deeper. So mm-hmm. now I can stop hiding that I'm a psychiatrist in the business world, because when people see deeper coaching and the way we explain it, so what'd you find out about yourself that, here's a little tip that may be relevant or irrelevant, but one of the things that a number of people find out about themselves is when you have good intentions, that doesn't make up for having a lousy way of interacting with people.
Mm-hmm.
I'll see a number of parents, and especially fathers, who can really come off as rough on their kids, and the kids push back and feel injured, and the father doesn't get it. Well, I don't wake up in the morning wanting to bully my children. I want to help them be the best they can, and I know how to be the best they can, and I'm just telling them how to do it. You know, I don't know why they're so upset when I tell them how to do it the right way and my way, because that'll make them successful like me. So I have good intentions. I don't understand why people have a problem with me. And when people find out that good intentions don't make up for a way of coming across that puts people down.
And that is exactly how it feels when people around me, they have good, I don't think anybody has bad intentions, but I have certainly heard the word coward.
Wow. Really?
For both of them. And I intrinsically don't think that they have bad intentions. Their delivery is horrific. I think with this particular type of death, people are just so frightened by it. They don't understand it. You know, they need their answers for why. You can't point to in their mind, cancer or heart attack or, you know, something like that. But their intentions, although good, cause pain.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? Losing someone is hard enough that you love anybody. It's hard enough. Grief sucks. Grief is hard. Grief is just the last thing we teach anything about. I mean, it's inevitable worldwide, but we don't have classes on how to deal with grief.
I'd like you to elaborate on, which I just recently learned, and I feel embarrassed that I really didn't get the nuance, but I was recently reading up on the difference between grief and mourning. And that grief is the actual loss. And the mourning is the beginning to heal by expressing your pain from the loss. And I never saw that distinction, you know, and that's why various religions have a mourning period, you know, and I think it's a useful distinction. I found it that way, that the grief is the loss just happened, you know, and I am grief stricken. I'm literally stricken with this. And the mourning is when we, as you said, I gave myself permission to heal. So you gave yourself permission to mourn.
Absolutely. And,
So does that make any sense to you, Marcy?
Well, I guess when I think in terms of mourning, I do think of more on a constricted time frame. When I think of the word mourning, because of certainly religious aspects of that, I do a lot of volunteer and humanitarian work on Native American reservations here. And certainly in their culture, there's a time of mourning, you know, cutting your hair, different things like that. And it's a time frame. And as we know, grief is this yucky ball of just yuck that bounces this way and that way and up and down and back and forth. And it can hit you years later. you know, even when you think you've done the best healing you can, and then a song comes, or you're at the beach, or something happens, and here it comes again. So I think of grief that way. Mourning is more, okay, wear black for a year. Okay, and then you're done. And then
that's a great, I like that, because a lot of people could feel guilty. Well, I thought you had the mourning period. Aren't you over it yet? So that's a great distinction, Marcy. Thank you.
Yeah, I agree.
Tell people you're never going to get over it, but you can get past it. I mean, I think people grieving think, I need to be over this by now. And when somebody finally, or read some, I think it was in a book, you're never going to get over it, because you don't. But you learn to get past it and live with it and find joy again, but you never get over it. And I think that's another stumbling block for people, is that their expectation of, you know, people saying you will get over it, time heals all wounds, you know, just those platitudes and cliches, which are just exactly that and nothing more. So I think that's a stumbling block.
We are coming close to the end of the show at this point, but I'm curious, talking about religion, how much does the religious notion that suicide is a sin still hold sway today? Is that something that you think is standing in the way of us accepting and being more tolerant?
As Dr. Mark said earlier about kind of someone asking you to kind of check in on what your feelings were. Okay. I did a webinar with about 600 employees from a behavioral health company, frontline workers. Part of that 988 phone number, answering those calls. And what I said to them was, check your own attitudes and your own beliefs about suicide before you know, my great aunt used to say, yeah, put it in your basket and walk around with it a bit, because you're going to come to them with those attitudes and those beliefs about suicide. Now, for me personally, I have a big faith. And I know that the Bible has 7 suicides in the Bible, not just Judas, as everybody kind of thinks. And God is relatively quiet on that subject. And so for me, although one of the first things my pool guy said to me after my first husband passed, as I walked outside to say hello to him, instead of, Marcy, how are you? Or, you know, he looked at me and said, do you think Paul's in heaven?
Wow.
It was in that moment, I thought, oh, this is going to be a long journey.
Yeah.
If this is the first thing you want to ask me, and I don't know, JJ, I discovered my husband on our patio with a gunshot wound in his head.
Oh.
So not only the loss, there was, you know, certainly I could have said I have post-traumatic stress kind of over it. I mean, I couldn't even shut my eyes for a couple of days because that's the only vision I saw. So knowing that, and then someone just asked, that's the question they want to ask me. I think that has everything to do with how we're raised and beliefs of the past and all of that. But it's just like we've been raised around the world. There are prejudices that we've been raised with, whether it's about race, religion, gender, all of that.
Yeah.
And yet we're willing to do better. We're willing to be better people and learn from each other and understand that, you know, we can all be different, but we're all human beings. Bottom line, we have that in common. We're just human beings. We all love. We all have hate sometimes, all that stuff. But when we can just lean into each other and listen, just listen. We don't have to solve your problem, but if I can listen to you and you know I'm listening.
Well, Marcy, thank you so much
for
everything. Thank you for all the work that you're doing. We are right at the end of the show now. Yeah, I think you've really inspired me, and I know Mark feels the same way. I'm sure I'm not speaking.
I feel really touched. Where can people find out more?
Well, MarcySavage.com. I have a website, and there's some other podcasts they can listen to that I've done, you know, and an article I wrote in the Huffington Post, and, you know, a few things, and reach out to me there. My mission is to tell my story, and I tell my story with a smile on my face and a resilience that, you know, you can get past hurt and bad things, and if you show up for yourself.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And on that note, it is time for us to go. So from me and Mark and Marcy, goodbye. We hope you'll join us again another time here on Hurt Less, Live More. Bye for now.